Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 3rd of November. Jennifer Granholm is going to be joining us momentarily, two-term governor of the state of Michigan, and she is now a distinguished practitioner of law and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. She's going to be starting a new television program, actually, Current TV, The War Room with Jennifer Granholm, which I believe starts in January. She is co-author with her husband, Dan Mulhern, of A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. She had a whale of a time in Michigan, as you can probably imagine. She was there during a financial crisis that threatened to put all America's major car companies into bankruptcy, and so she dealt with that. She did a lot with education reform, economic revitalization, energy policy, infrastructure development. She had close access to the White House. She stood in for Sarah Palin during Joe Biden's debate preparation. And she is originally from Vancouver, Canada, a gorgeous place in the world, grew up in California, wanted to be a movie star. So we'll talk about that some, and decided she would go another route because she didn't like being in Hollywood very much. The book tells a number of different stories, and she will be with us in just a moment. She's on Meet the Press frequently. She has a lot to talk about, and she'll be calling in momentarily. A few things this morning. We still have some unclaimed museum tickets. If you enter the drawing, please check your Facebook messages, because a couple of you have some passes and you didn't respond. If you did receive a message from us, please email your address. We will give the winners until the end of next week to claim the passes before we offer them to another listener, because a lot of people wanted to see this show. So please do that. We also have, I'm reminded by my young producers, a Twitter account where I believe you tweet on your Twitter. And we have been using this with more frequency, so you can follow us at the Twitter place, the K Dunn Show. Also, a few upcoming shows of note. Barbara Ehrenreich will be joining us, author of such books as Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, Brightsided, How Positive Thinking is Undermining America, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. She will be with us next Tuesday at 9 in the morning, and she has been following the Occupy protests all over the country pretty carefully. Chris Matthews, host of Hardball on MSNBC, who has been shamelessly promoting his new book on his show, but that's all right. He's Chris. You gotta love Chris. He's got enthusiasm, and he's like my Irish cousin who I want to have come to my Thanksgiving dinner. He'll be with us next Thursday at 10 o'clock. He has a new book on Jack Kennedy, and it's been getting very good reviews. So that will be Thursday. Broadcaster and journalist Tom Brokaw will be with us on the 15th of November at 10 o'clock. And his new book is The Time of Our Lives, A Conversation About America. We also have a fabulous book written by Edmund Morris on Teddy Roosevelt. Colonel Roosevelt is the name of the book, and that's coming up next week as well. So that's just a few of the programs you'll have a chance to look forward to, thanks to our great producers, Rhonda and Chrissy. And Jennifer Granholm is joining us momentarily now. I think she just called in. Her book is A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. As I said, she's going to start a television show, I believe, in January on Current TV. And she is co-author of this book with her husband, Dan Mulhern. She is currently a distinguished practitioner of law and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, senior advisor to the Pew Charitable Trust Clean Energy Program, and was two-term governor of the state of Michigan during some very rough economic times. Governor Granholm, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
So glad to be on. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I just saw you on television on Meet the Press, and now I understand you're going to be on television regularly.
Right, 5 nights a week.
Whoa.
For political junkies. Yeah, it's great. It's going to be called, it's a show on Current TV, which is a new cable network that is owned by Al Gore and Joel Hyatt. And so I'll be following Keith Olbermann. He's on, I think, in Wisconsin time, probably from 7 to 8. So I will be on from 8 to 9 o'clock, and it's going to be focused, starting in January, on the 2012 election.
Ooh. Will you have guests, or are you going to talk
all
hour? You'll have guests.
Absolutely. me alone for an hour is not what people want to see. But but for sure, it will be election central, so we'll be really focusing on the ins and outs, the policy and the politics related to 2012.
Well, that should be fun. A lot of work.
A lot of work. Yeah, it's a full-time gig.
Right. I wanted to start with the early part of your book when you took, because I'm interested in what people do when they're very young. And I had no idea you really, for a while, entertained the thought of being an actress.
Yeah, right out of high school. I don't know how my parents allowed me to do this, but I went to Los Angeles thinking that I could become the female Sir Laurence Olivier. And that didn't last too long, really. It was a short-lived stint, and then I got serious and went to college.
And you got really serious when you were in college.
Yeah, for sure. I was really became obsessed with, you know, like a lot of college students, with changing the world. I really wanted to do something that would have impact, and so I went to Berkeley, and then was fortunate to be able to get into Harvard, where I met my husband. But I'm not from Michigan originally. I was born in Canada and was raised in California, and so I met my husband at law school, and I married Michigan, married the Midwest, and love it dearly.
Married the Midwest and was governor of a state when it was going through perhaps one of the most difficult times in its entire history.
Right. Every state went through a tough period in the last decade, but because of our concentration in automotive manufacturing, Michigan entered the recession. There was a recession that was in 2001, 2002. We thought we were going to emerge with the rest of the country. We never emerged. For this entire decade, the past decade, 2000 through 2010, Michigan went through an economic restructuring, essentially, the likes of which we had never seen because of the loss of manufacturing and automotive manufacturing jobs. So it was a really challenging period of time. I liked one of the reasons why we wrote this book is because people right now are scratching their heads over how to create jobs in America in a global economy when we're competing with economic competitors whose businesses are paying, you know, a buck an hour or something like that. And the point of this book is really to say that we can't apply the solutions that we applied in the 20th century because of the flattening of the world and the technology and the movement of capital. And we're seeing right now even what Greece's impact is on a global economy. And Greece is about the size of Michigan.
Right.
And the point in globalization is that the solutions have to be different. We have to be very strategic as a nation. And that's why what's happening to the country happened to Michigan first. Mm-hmm. And it was important to be able to get that story down.
I found it interesting. One of your responses to this was to get on many airplanes and to go around the world and try and talk to companies and say, listen, why don't you come home? Did you get many to come home? And what did you say to them to entice them?
Right. Well, come home, meaning I went to international companies and asked them to come to Michigan to hire our citizens, companies that maybe have not done global work in the United States. So I went a lot to Japan, a lot to Germany, a lot to advanced industrial nations that maybe had mid-sized companies who wanted to do business in the U.S. but didn't know how, you know, didn't have a soft landing, didn't have a handshake. And so we had goals about getting international companies to come to Michigan to hire our citizens. I took 12 trips, got over 50 companies to come, and they created about 20,000 jobs. And I didn't just go to any old company. We were very strategic about targeting the sectors that we knew we could create clusters of industry for. So in Michigan, obviously, automotive was a natural. Advanced manufacturing was a natural. Clean energy was a natural. We had identified specific sectors that could make Michigan global, not just competing against Wisconsin or against Ohio, but competing globally. And that, to me, is a lesson that the U.S. should take on. We should have every ambassador to the United States, from the United States, saying, what is my target for getting a number of companies to come to the U.S. and hire U.S. citizens? Other countries do this all the time, and we do not as a nation. We don't have those specific, they're called foreign direct investment goals. And if we don't, I mean, we will be taken advantage of by the globe, but we will not take advantage of it. We've been victimized by globalization. We need to now go and take advantage of it.
And what did Michigan have to offer Governor Granholm that China wouldn't have to offer or India wouldn't have to offer with very inexpensive labor costs?
Right. And so we had to target things where the workforce was not, it was not just about cost. And this is a lesson for the country that we're never going to be the cheapest place to do business, to make things. So we have to decide what kind of things are we going to make? What advanced manufacturing can we have a leg up in our competitiveness? And so we targeted, for example, clean energy. For like, here's a very specific example. We said we're the place where auto 1.0 was built, so we want to be the place where auto 2.0 is built, meaning the electric vehicle. It's natural for us. We've got the supplier base. Obviously, you have to dovetail with the federal government and their goals to make the United States independent of foreign oil. We want to be the place because we have the high level of skill, the workers that can get this done. So when we said that, we put state tax credits on the table for battery manufacturers for the electric vehicle. The battery is the lithium ion battery. Before we had done this, all of those batteries were made in Asia. So we said if we don't want to substitute our reliance on foreign oil for a reliance on foreign batteries, and the president did the same, said the same thing. So the Department of Energy put out grants through the Recovery Act saying we want to be able to make our electric vehicle and the guts to that vehicle in the U.S. They put out a competition. We partnered with specific battery manufacturers. We identified them. We identified the supply chain for them. And we partnered with them in making an application to the federal government for those battery grants. And as a result, Michigan got more than half of all the battery grants, and in the space of 18 months, we were able to get 18 companies, battery companies, to come to Michigan to build that electric vehicle battery. So that's an example of a cluster that we identified where we could be competitive and where we knew we had a partner in the federal government to get that capital and technology in the ground.
Yeah, that's quite remarkable. Let's talk more about the auto industry. I was feeling for you when you took the phone call from the President of the United States saying that GM was about to declare bankruptcy.
Right.
What a thing to have to deal with.
Well, you know, we often say in Michigan that as goes GM, so goes Michigan. And so when the president called me that night, of course, I knew that we had been working with them for a long period of time, and he had already put Chrysler into bankruptcy. But it was sort of, for me personally, a tipping point, knowing that Michigan would never be the same. And in fact, you know, we're so glad to see that the auto industry is rebounding, but we will never recover the level of employment that we had, obviously, in the last century in automotive manufacturing because of technology and because of globalization and the loss of market share on the part of the big three automakers. When he made that call to me, it was just a realization that the rebound, the full rebound of Michigan was not going to occur, certainly in my term, and that it was going to take a long period of time to bounce back. But I'm happy to report yesterday, Bloomberg did an analysis, they released an analysis of all of the states, and since 2008, Michigan has bested 48 other states in terms of its economic rebound, how it's fared since the deep part of the recession. So, and in 2010, our unemployment rate dropped six times faster than the national average, and the Gallup Index said that we were the most improved in terms of job improvement performance. So Michigan is on track, but we've got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. And tell me how the auto companies were able to rebound, to pay back those loans that they were given.
Well, they were very strategic. Honestly, they had a partnership with labor, and this is a really important point. The new head of the UAW is a fellow named Bob King, and when he was elected, and it was right in the middle of this crisis, he went before the management of the auto companies at an annual seminar that they have in Traverse City, Michigan, and said, "This is not your father's UAW. It used to be in the last century that it was management versus labor. Now we recognize that we are competing against the globe. And so we need to be partners in making sure that we have job creation in the United States. And for that, you need to have the best skilled workforce with the best quality product. And that, when he said that, and partnered with management, partnered with the auto industry in bringing down the costs of those contracts, adopting, you know, a pretty controversial tiered wage system, offloading the benefits into a voluntary employment benefit association, basically taking the legacy costs off the automakers, all of those steps helped to position the auto industry for rebound. And then when the products themselves, now they are topping the list of quality, et cetera, and they've moved into huge fuel efficiency. Again, the Obama administration is to be credited for this, because prior to them, there had been resistance on the part of the auto industry for increasing fuel economy standards. And now you've got very robust fuel economy standards, a real commitment to the electrification of the vehicle, and a more streamlined process, that restructuring and elimination of divisions that were sort of diffusing and diluting the best products. All of that occurred because the bankruptcy made that possible.
Mm-hmm. Governor Granholm, when you entered office, you faced a massive budget deficit, such as the case in Wisconsin, in Ohio, and other states. Can you talk about how you dealt with public workers, with public unions, as in light of that deficit?
Yeah, I can tell you I didn't bash them, and I didn't try to pass laws that limit stripped their collective bargaining rights. What I did was, and let me just put this into context, because Michigan's entire decade was a decade of contraction because of the auto industry and the loss of revenues to state government, we every year had a deficit. And so over that period of time, I cut more out of state government than any state in the country as a percentage. And that was true for state employees as well. We had to lose state employees, and we had fewer state employees by the time I left. Than we had in the 70s. So by a long shot, we cut more public employees than any state in the country. Also reduced taxes, by the way. Our corporate tax burden dropped more than any state in the country. So you would think that if those prescriptions were the prescriptions that got a state on track, that we would have the most robust economy in the nation. And the reality was that we had the highest unemployment rate still because of the structure of our economy. Our state employees were incredibly helpful in identifying the waste and excess inside of state government that enabled me to do all of the cutting that we did. They offered, it was tough. We were at the bargaining table, but they offered enormous concessions. And, you know, the idea that you cannot negotiate across a bargaining table with a public employee union, and we're a heavily unionized state in Michigan, and get the success that you need, is complete bunk. You have to respect the employees. And by the way, as any CEO would tell you of any public or private sector corporation, these are the ones who are delivering service. And if you vilify them, that will not achieve the results both in service, and it certainly won't achieve the results that you would like in terms of cooperation.
Before we go to phone calls, in the Midwest, in other parts of the country as well, but particularly in the Midwest, there's been a heavy manufacturing base, and many, many of those jobs have just disappeared over the past 30 or 40 years. Tell me about the displaced workers that you were working with being retrained. I understand it was at a level four times the national average. How did you retrain former manufacturing workers?
Yeah, we had more of those kind of workers, obviously, than anywhere else. Obviously, Wisconsin knows well that issue. We created something called No Worker Left Behind, and that was an employee retraining or a worker retraining initiative that was really guided by and done through the community colleges. But here's the catch. I mean, I actually stood up at a State of the State address, and I said to Michigan, if you are unemployed or underemployed and you want to be retrained for a job where you're much more likely to get a job at the end of the retraining, then come and we will pay your tuition for 2 years for $5,000 per person. But the catch, $5,000 per person per year, so up to $10,000, to pay your tuition. But the catch is you cannot be trained in an area that is not relevant to what the economy that we are trying to shape is. So we wouldn't pay for people to get degrees in political science or French. Those are my degrees, so I can say that as an undergrad. But we would pay for people to get a degree in healthcare, in advanced manufacturing, in clean energy.
Oh, dear. Hello?
Into. And so, as a result, we had, by the time I left, we had over 150,000 Michigan citizens who had enrolled in the training, and the results were really quite amazing, because we decided the kinds of jobs based upon what the employers were telling us they needed, the skill level and the certifications that they needed, and the movement that we were pushing in terms of trying to get the industries that would help diversify us. 4 times the national average is what the results were in terms of not just training, but success in landing positions once they were through the training. 82% of the people who went through the training got jobs in the area that they want, that they trained in, which is phenomenal.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is the former governor of the state of Michigan, two-term governor, Jennifer Granholm. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Her story, written with her husband, Dan Mulhern, and their story is an interesting one as well, because he essentially was, they're very, very close. They talk about issues all the time, but they decided that she should run for governor, and so he did some work, but essentially did a lot of being a stay-at-home dad, raising the children, 3 children. Her book, written with Dan Mulhern, is A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. We should also tell you that come January, she will be on Current TV 5 days a week as we go into heavy-duty election season. She will have a program, and it is The War Room with Jennifer Granholm. I'm Kathleen Dunn. To your calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, starting with Carolyn in Superior. Hi, Carolyn.
Yes, not long ago, there was an announcement that China is going to be the recipient of the manufacturer of the Volt. GM is moving that manufacturer to China. How is that going to affect the recovery in Michigan?
Yeah, let me just be clear. They're not moving the U.S. manufacturer to China. They are expanding their footprint in China and developing the Volt there for the Chinese market. So it's not going to reduce the manufacturing in Michigan. Although, believe me, I was worried about it when I heard that. But then I followed up and learned that they are just expanding their footprint. And, you know, I mean, this is a really important point. Our economic competitors, like China, they are very aggressive about making sure that if U.S. companies want to sell into China, that they manufacture there. I don't know why we are not more aggressive as a nation in saying, if you want to come to the U.S. and sell your products here, manufacture here. It's a, we're not going to do it exactly like China does, obviously, but we have not been playing hardball with trying to get and create and keep jobs in the United States. And we must partner with businesses to make a good business case for them to locate here. And part of that is playing offense, part of that is playing defense, and part of that is using the trade system, the global trade system, as a way to play offense on behalf of our own companies. So, I mean, when I say that, I mean, we've been a pussycat at enforcing trade agreements at the World Trade Organization, and we need a tiger. And these other countries that are aggressively going after our companies, as well as other global companies, they are doing a number of things to make it irresistible for them to locate there. It's not just about wages. In fact, wages are just 7% of the cost of a vehicle. It is about partnering with them to get their technology and their equipment in the ground. It's about streamlining permitting. In fact, I was moderating a panel of international CEOs earlier this year, and the question was, what should be the role of the U.S. government in keeping and creating jobs in the United States in a global economy? And I said to them, you guys are all international. which country does it best? Who's got the best model for getting jobs and creating jobs in their country? And they all said Singapore. And I said, well, what is Singapore doing that the U.S. should be doing? And they said they make it easy for companies to go there, and they offer help in getting their technology and equipment in the ground by offering them low-interest loans, access to capital. They cluster their strategic strengths of industry. So what Singapore has done is identified where their strengths are, and they've gone after the industries that dovetail with their strengths. And so, for example, one of the industries that Singapore is interested in is logistics, movement of goods across the globe because they're on ports. So they go after companies that for whom that is important, and they create a supplier base and a customer base, and maybe they create industry parks that are relative to that. And they make it easy for them to locate there. We have got to be active. And the whole point of this, one of the big important points to this book is that the philosophy of the U.S. being hands-off with business, laissez-faire, trickle-down, supply side, those were all fine theories in the 20th century. But in the 21st century, when our economic competitors are being much more active and aggressive in intervening in the economy, like China, then we have got to get in the game.
Thanks very much, Carolyn, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. The former governor of Michigan, two-term governor, Jennifer Granholm, is our guest, and we're talking about Michigan and her book, just released, A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. We go to Randy next. Hi, Randy.
Yes, Governor. What you did there worked because we had a business here in Wisconsin that we were going to have to move because we got no cell phone or cell signal. We looked around the globe and could not find help getting signal out here. We found the help in little startup companies in Michigan, believe it or not. They came, we in Sanford, Michigan, we chose a company. They came here, built a cell phone tower for us, to magnify and amplify the signal. We get broadband now. We saved our rural company. It was actually relatively inexpensive to do when you look at what basically a computer does. I have invited my congressman, anybody to come here and look and see what they did. They talk about rural broadband. It could be done anywhere. Those companies started up really largely because I asked the young man who came, where did you learn this technology? Only one company in Wisconsin does even have the tools. I bought the tools because I have to every now and then put a new wire in my home here and in my business because it's next to my home. So what you did worked.
Well, what's the name of your company? You got to get a pitch in now.
Hey, well, my wife has an insurance company. She's in lines of insurance that deal with aging issues, which has grown, and she's very, very helpful, and the people she works with like her. So her business has grown, and in these times, economic times, she offers a good service. So I don't want to embarrass her. I plug her all the time. I don't want to embarrass her. But
I understand. I don't think you'd be embarrassing her because you are touting her company. But the point being that governments have a role. And obviously, connectivity is a huge role, and creating the backbone for that inside of states means that you have to invest in making that happen. That is clearly a 21st century piece of infrastructure that government has a role in. But if we continue as a nation to slash and slash and slash and not invest in that infrastructure, then we will not be globally competitive.
Thanks, Randy, very much for your call. We go to Teddy on the road. Hi, Teddy.
Hi, how are you?
All right, Teddy, how are you?
Oh, Brian. Listen, I was wondering if the governor, I mean, I travel the world a lot and I see a lot of different state economies, I guess you would say. But at any rate, I was just wondering if the governor could apply her philosophy, which is just, she articulates it so well, it's obvious to me, and I'm no rocket scientist, but could you apply it nationally somehow?
Kathleen, I'm not sure I heard the question clearly. Can you repeat it?
Yeah, he said he travels all over the country. He likes what you're saying. He wants to know if this can be applied nationally some way.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, if the states are to be the laboratories of democracy, if we're going to take these experiments inside of the states to scale, then that's why we wrote this book, is that there are things we learned. There's things I did wrong, and there's things I did right that we can learn from nationally. And one of them is making sure that government is active, not big government, because obviously we weren't very big, but an active, strategic, smart government that identifies the U.S.'s strengths regionally, works with the states, but gives the states the tools to compete globally. And when I say that, you know, it's a really dumb national strategy for states to simply compete with one another for jobs. And that's exactly what happens, is that I compete with Wisconsin. Wisconsin offers tax incentives. Michigan offers tax incentives for the same company. And all we're doing is moving a company from one state to another inside of our country. That's a dumb national strategy, because you're just moving the chairs around on the deck of the Titanic. Instead, we should be growing the pie. And that's why you need a national strategy to partner with the states to compete globally based upon the strengths of each state.
Here's an email that has come in critical of your education policies. It's from Wanda. Being a teacher in Michigan, we were disappointed as education employees that she didn't do more for our profession. To add insult to injury, we have become the scapegoat for the current Michigan politicians. Michigan cannot be a leader of technology without an educated task force that comes from public education.
Yeah, I totally agree with her. I was disappointed that we couldn't continue to invest. You know, we had to sort of hold K through 12 harmless and had to cut higher education because I had the legislature, one house, controlled by those who didn't believe in investing in public education, unfortunately. But one of the things that I give my plaudits to is the Obama administration for investing in and inciting a competition among states, really, to raise the standards for K through 12. We actually did this in 2005, that every child has now a college prep curriculum in high school, which is great. And we've been able to see the benefit of that, in that the results in terms of scores, et cetera, continue to rise. That's really important. There has to be more. But the point she's making is that unless people who you elect, and that's both sides, please, unless they get how critical investment in the future workforce is, then we will again continue to slip. If you look at the U.S.'s rankings globally, we used to be at the top in reading, science, and math. And now, among the advanced countries, we are 17th and dropping in these categories. Because we're doing nothing more to invest in our children. And so that investment, it's not just about money, it's about how you do it as well. I do think that we've got to take a different look at how long kids are spending in school, how much time we're spending learning. If our economic competitors who jumped over us are spending a third more time in class, a third more time learning, and that's why they're doing better than we are, then we've got to adopt models that work. But that's going to take serious focus, and that clearly is a role for government. Public education.
What do you think of her comment? She talked about teachers becoming the scapegoat for current Michigan politicians. Do you agree?
Well, I do agree that public employees and teachers have become scapegoated, and it's such a travesty that it's such a travesty that we look at the people who are educating our kids as somehow part of the problem rather than the solution that will lead us out. If you look at how teachers are respected in other states and the respect for the profession that we have in other countries, and you see the respect for the profession that has evolved in the United States, it's a travesty. We should be, honestly, these teachers should be the most respected profession. We should be bowing to them as they do in Japan and in other countries like Korea, where they are incredibly respected, that we should be attracting the best and the brightest. And when you continue to vilify them or say that they're greedy or say that they don't work hard or whatever the other dumb things are that people say about educators, then we, again, as a nation, will continue to slip globally, economically and educationally. So she's right. They have been vilified. It's not just in Michigan. It's in other places. And it's not all politicians, obviously. It's certain ones who believe that we should privatize education or move in a different direction. And I just fundamentally disagree with that.
David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
I can't agree with you more. I read a good article on Finland. They actually spend less time in school, but what they did is invest heavily in teacher mentoring and programs to improve the teaching quality, and they're right at the top now. Doesn't that send tons of homework? Matter of fact, they showed some studies saying sending too much homework actually is detrimental, what I call it. But my point I was making, I'm 55. I have a bad back. I went back to school. But, you know, people take a look at anyone with any slight disability, and they don't hire them because of insurance and stuff. I mean, that is, you know, you train people, and these employers have to start hiring. I mean, if you're going to only have 100% healthy people, most Americans have something wrong.
It's a really important point in terms of people with disabilities as well as people who have been out of work for a long time are viewed often by employers because it's a buyer's market, it's an employer's market, as not as worthy. And often, of course, the work that we're doing now doesn't require your back, it requires your mind. It's why healthcare reform has been so important, so that you cannot reject somebody because of pre-existing conditions. It's why healthcare, if I can just say a word about healthcare, in the United States, we pay twice as much per person, and we don't cover, there's however many millions of people who are uninsured, and the outcomes are not as good. It's another example of how our global competitors may be doing this better, and we can learn from other countries about how to get better outcomes at less the cost, at half the cost, and cover everyone. But the resistance to government involvement in this is really irrational. Unless, right now we have a private sector system where the employers bear a huge percentage of the burden. In other countries, the employers are not bearing the burden. It is a shared cost across the nation. And therefore, the employers are not disadvantaged by locating in that country. There's more manufacturing that occurs now, more auto manufacturing in Ontario, Canada, than in Michigan. And those employers are not going there because of wages or because of regulations. They're going there because they don't have to bear the full freight of health care insurance. And so if we as a country decide that it's important for us to be competitive as well as humane, then we have to realize that health care reform is an important step in that direction.
Governor, let's talk a little bit about your family life, because that's a compelling part of this story as well. Your husband is a very accomplished man. He cares deeply about all of these issues. How did you make the decision who would run for governor, you or your husband?
Well, I didn't. It wasn't something that we sat down and said, okay, who's going to go, you or me? I didn't see myself as running for office at all. In fact, when we met at law school, Dan is very accomplished. He's a very deep thinker. He's a very smart guy. And when he was growing up in Michigan, he comes from a great Irish Catholic family. He wanted to either be president or pope. So when he went to college, he majored in theology, was probably going to be headed to the seminary. And then we met, so he didn't become a priest, but he did become a saint for marrying me. And when we were preparing for marriage, the priest said to him, and when it was clear that he wasn't going to go into theology, but we were both very interested in politics, he said, what if the party comes to Jennifer and asks her to run for senator or some other thing? What would you do? And he said, I'd probably be a bit jealous, but if that's what she wanted to do, I'd be behind her 100%. Well, the priest got the office wrong, but in fact, that's exactly what happened, is that the party came to me when the slot for attorney general was open in Michigan, and so I ran for attorney general with his support. I would never have been able to do attorney general or governor if I did not have the greatest man in the world supporting me. He decided, because our kids were young, he decided that he was going to let go of his business and his commitments to be the full-time dad. And our kids have benefited enormously from that. And it's really a story, frankly, for men all over the country that you know, sometimes maybe, the and he's very well suited for this, Dan is, if you put our sort of personal characteristics, regardless of gender, on the table, I'm the person who likes to get things done, I'm making a list, I'm checking it off, I'm go, go, go. He likes to smell the roses. He loves, he's very patient, he's very heart-centered. He is such a fantastic dad. And so this has been an opportunity, not just for the kids, but for him as well, to really soar with his strengths. Now, he's teaching at Berkeley, he's teaching in the business school, our kids are two of them are in college or out of college, got one still in high school, but he's really been able, I think, to do a remarkable thing that many men don't have the chance to do or maybe don't even think about doing.
Yeah, it is such an important thing in our lives. What about the children? Are any of them interested in entering politics, Governor?
Well, they're all very, they're very passionate about politics. I'm not sure that they see themselves as running for office, but I know that they are interested in the policy associated with moving forward. For example, our middle daughter took a year off in between high school and college to go do a year of service with AmeriCorps. She was in, she was put into public schools in New Orleans as they were doing restructuring of their education system. She came out completely passionate about public education policy in the United States. So our second daughter, who's, I mean, our oldest daughter, who obviously is older than her, she graduated from the University of Michigan, and she then is right now in a year off and working in Detroit public schools because it's with City Year, which is a year of service also. I think, and for any of your listeners, I just think this year of service thing is such a fantastic opportunity, especially in a lousy economy, but even not, for kids to get their act together, to see what they're interested in, and to give back to the world. It really opens their eyes.
I agree with you. More phone calls in a moment. The former governor, two-term governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, is our guest this hour. We're talking about her life, about her time as governor when all hell broke loose on many fronts in terms of the economy. Her book is A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Future. And we do want to tell you that she's starting a five-day-a-week television program on Current TV, The War Room with Jennifer Granholm, which will look at all the political issues during the heavy-duty political year of 2012. More phone calls in a moment. Did I give you the number? It's 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, the news about Argentina caught our attention a little while ago with the re-election of the Argentina president. And they have this booming economy. There's a great deal of concern about inflation, but we're going to look at why that economy is one of the strongest in the whole world. Maria Victoria Murillo, a professor of political science and international and public affairs at Columbia University, will be with us. So it should be an interesting show. The governor of Michigan for two terms, Jennifer Granholm, is our guest this hour. Her book, A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. And we go to Scott in Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, and good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
I guess I kind of consider myself somewhat of a reasonable conservative, and I totally agree with your point regarding health insurance. I think we need to get it out of the employer's hand. I think it should be a shared event. I think we really do need a single-payer plan here in the United States, and that's odd to hear from a conservative. But back to the education, because I think education is where jobs are created, is the higher the education. And I think you do a disservice to it, because we spend, according to the Council of Economic Cooperative Economic Development, we spend more on primary education than only one other country, and we spend more on secondary education than three other countries. Money isn't always the issue. And the other issue is, when you say we should be bowing down to teachers, I think that's rather divisive, putting one group ahead of another. I don't value teachers any more than I value the guy that changes my oil. I value everybody that provides a service for me. And when you put a particular group of people on a pedestal, the only place for them to come is down. And I think we need to value everybody instead of saying we should be bowing down to teachers. I think that causes division.
All right.
Great. I didn't intend to say that one person is more valuable than another, but I do I am concerned about the trends which tend to vilify public employees and teachers in particular. I think your point about the costs and about money is a very important point. We have to be strategic about where those dollars are going. And it's not always more. It is targeting the money to the best outcome. And so the movement to be able to reward outcomes, I think, is a good movement. I think that, you know, reward outcomes in terms of both educators and schools and school districts, but also help them to get kids, especially kids in challenged areas, whether they're rural or urban, to be able to jump over this higher bar. But my point about teachers is really that we ought to respect this profession, and it will encourage more great teachers to come in if they feel like it is a respected profession.
Here's an email. You are expecting this question, I'm sure, at some point from Tim. Have you considered running for president in 2016? Tim thinks you would be an excellent candidate.
Bless your heart. I am born in Canada, and so I have a constitutional cement ceiling that would preclude me from even considering it.
So I guess not. And Scott, thank you very much for the call. We've got a Pat in Brookfield. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. I want to kind of echo Scott's comments a little bit. I'm not sure about the debate in Michigan, but what I heard here in Wisconsin is I didn't hear a lot of vilifying the teachers. I think the left and the Democrats try to make that the narrative, but I remember every time Scott Walker speaking was complimenting our teachers, went out of his way to compliment our public employees. And simply the debate was about what can we do here? Do we want to spend some more money in the classrooms and cut down on the pay and salaries a little bit? Or do we want to keep a system in place, which we found out we can't afford? We need to go back and remember the previous 4 years in the two balanced budget. We balanced the budget by stimulus money, raising taxes, and raiding funds, which we've now had to pay back. I think we took a look at it and said, listen, we cannot put more of this burden on the taxpayer. And if you look at the percentages now that our public employees are paying, they're pretty much average across the nation. So,
okay, let's get a response. Governor Granholm.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what he was saying. I mean, I don't disagree that everybody has to share in a sacrifice. But the point, I think, that got the nation riled up about what was happening in Wisconsin was that there was a disrespect of employee rights. It was the collective bargaining aspect of things that that was very disconcerting. And that seemed, that was certainly to me and to others who were watching it, was disrespecting the public employees and their decision to be able to be at to discuss this over a bargaining table rather than ramming it through a legislature because somebody may have had a majority of his party. So the question is, can you get the kind of changes in public education, especially in benefits and wages, at a bargaining table rather than having it imposed by fiat by either school district, but through the fact that you've taken away their collective bargaining rights.
Thanks, Pat, very much for the call. I'd like for you to assess the presidency here for a moment, Governor Granholm. Do you see President Obama moving in a different direction, becoming a little bit more forceful as we enter the 2012 campaign?
Yes, and I'm loving it, honestly. I think he's found his voice. I think he had to demonstrate in his first couple of years that he was willing to compromise, that he was a reasonable person, the adult in the room. But when the Republicans demonstrated that they weren't willing to compromise on any revenue in any way, shape, or form, that that was their end-all and be-all, and that's why they were sent to Washington, is to bring it down, basically, to not compromise, or at least not all of them, but the ones who are led by the Tea Party, then I think once that happened, it was clear that he wasn't going to get any of his provisions. I mean, if you look at just this Jobs Act that he put on the table now that has a huge number of provisions in it that previously have been proposed by Republicans in Congress and that they aren't going to vote for them now, it just shows that there is an irrational opposition to anything that the president puts forward, so that he's getting his fighting legs under him, I think is good, because the only remedy for him, honestly, is to be able to get people put into office that will compromise, that will work with him. You know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners saw the debate where the Republicans were asked, would you take a compromise that allowed you 10 parts cuts to one part revenue? And not a single person would take that deal. What does that say to you? It says to you that you've got people that are completely unwilling to compromise. You ask any business person, any CEO, whether they would take a deal like that, of course they would. Any rational person would. You have to be pragmatic. And if the president has demonstrated he's willing to be pragmatic and he doesn't get a partner on the other side, then he needs to get new partners. And he's fighting to make that happen.
Governor Granholm, I enjoyed the hour so much. Thank you very much for being with us, and thanks for the
Kathleen,
book.
Can I just say one other quick word?
Yes.
One of the great successes that we had, and Governor Doyle and I went after this, was to get in up in Marinette, Marinette Marine, which was an Italian-based company called Fincantieri. We both went to Italy and brought them back. I'm so proud of that, because it's creating a lot of jobs in the north, and I just have to give a shout out to the folks at Marinette Marine and
okay.
the folks who may be hired by them as they make ships.
I'm sure they'll
the West government.
They'll love to hear that. Thank you, Governor Granholm. The book is A Governor's Story: The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Chrissy Pease for on-air production. We'll return after we hear about what's going on in the world.